On today's Author Stories, Brian Cohen challenges us to the 5-day Amazon Ad Profit Challenge. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. PicosHouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretend she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro, is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today, visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Martin W. Sandler on the show with me today. He has written one of probably the most important books and the most fun to read books that I've had all year. We're recording this the end of 2019, and you're probably hearing this in the brand new year of 2020. But the book is called 1919. The Year That Changed America. What a fantastic book. Thank you for joining me today, Martin.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. When I first got this book in the mail from your publicist, it really piqued my interest right away. It's a very beautiful book. It's well produced, lots and lots of photographs and great, you know, essays along the way. And immediately, it was one of those books that I started flipping through, and then I found myself sitting on the couch with it, and it had been like 2 hours, and I was just completely immersed. So first off, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory
of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, that's very interesting. Well, I'm going to tell you a story. We good time, I know. I grew up in New Bedford, Massachusetts. There was no television. Hell, there was almost no electricity. But anyway, there was no television. We all read the newspaper, even us who were 15 years old. And every newspaper had great columnists. And the number one columnist in America was a guy named Peter Findlay Dunne. And he had two characters, two immigrants named Mr. Hennessy and Mr. Dooley, and through what they said, he got his message across. And one day I'm reading it, and Hennessy said to Dooley, "Dooley, do you ever read history?" And Dooley says, "Nah." And he says, "Why not?" He says, "Well, I find that historians is like doctors. They take the temperature, they feel the pulse, and they tell you what a country died of. If somebody comes along and tells me what a country lived of, then I will start reading history." And I don't know why. I was 15 years old. I was a kid. And I was much more interested in playing baseball. But I got to tell you, that struck me. And I said, you know what? I think that's what I want to do. I think that's what I want to make history come alive. And for some reason, I've stayed with it for a lot of years. And I have worked to find ways to make history come alive, mainly through letting the people in the story tell the story as much as I can, but through other ways, too. Because I just find that it's me, but I just find that nonfiction is far more interesting than fiction if it's written right or taught right. And I find that it's the most human of all disciplines. And so I feel very privileged to have been able to earn my keep by doing that.
What an amazing challenge set out before you. It's such a simple statement, but says so. There's so much subtext to what you said about, you know, what historians convey what a nation died of, but give me something to tell me how they lived. That is such an amazing, that really gets to the heart of how we view the past. And this idea that we are so much more advanced than any time in history. And we have proven that over and over again, that just because we are advanced in years doesn't mean we have advanced morally or, you know, technologically in a lot of ways.
That's right.
Yeah. What was it about 1919 that, other than, you know, this centennial year from that, but what was it about this time that made you take a deeper look?
Well, it's interesting. You know, publishers are crazy about anniversaries. You know,
sure.
They're always saying to us authors, you know, can you write, can you see anything that's the 50th anniversary of or the 100th anniversary of? I got to tell you that, you know, I've done a couple of books like that. And up until this one, you know, I never sold three more books because it was an anniversary. But that's all right. I got some good books out of it. But when I looked into 1919, not suspecting what I was going to find, I went a little nuts, because I'm looking at it. And what I'm finding is that in 1919, women got the vote. In 1919, Prohibition came in. In 1919, these two guys named Alcock and Brown conquer the greatest challenge, physical challenge of their day, really. They fly nonstop across the Atlantic 8 years before Lindbergh. In 1919, there are more race riots and lynchings than any time in our history. In 1919, we have a flu epidemic that in 1 year kills 300,000 Americans and worldwide kills 50 million people, and that's greater toll than the plagues. In 1919, we have the greatest sports scandal we ever had in this country, the Black Sox scandal. In 1919, the Red Scare becomes the absolute precursor to McCarthyism later on. And in 1919, more than 40 people die, and two firehouses are driven into the Boston Harbor by a 45-foot wave of molasses, of all things. I mean, that's crazy. And then, you know, I look at it, and that would have been enough to have me do the book. I would have done it right there. But then when I see that all these things are related, and then, even more important, when I see that so many of them are so relevant to today, I say, my God, I'll kill myself before I won't do this book. Of course I'm going to do this book. So it's been a joy to do, because it's there. And I feel a little embarrassed that I didn't know about it a lot earlier than I did, but nobody else did, so I guess that's all right.
I guess so. The connectedness of all of these events, and so many events that we look back on happened in this time. What was it about this year that seems to be so special or infamous in a lot of ways?
Well, you know, I guess a lot of these things had been building, but it's just like everything that takes place. I mean, there are lots of momentous years, but everything that takes place has such incredible fallout and relevance for us for today. For example, you know, even what might be, even though it's the sexiest thing, it might be the molasses flood. Even that has incredibly serious ramifications, because the molasses flood came about because World War I is ending, and the munitions manufacturers know that their days of selling munitions are going to be limited for the foreseeable future. And molasses is the key ingredient in making explosions. So they better make and store as much molasses as they can for a quick sale as possible. Also, they know that the prohibition is imminent. So that's going to drive out the market for rum, which is one of the great selling products there is. So they better store and sell as much rum as they can. This is a time when there isn't one building code in the United States. So they throw this tank up without any blueprints, without any engineers aboard, just a bunch of hack craftsmen throw this tank together. It starts to leak and contracts from day one, and then it explodes. And all these people are killed. But what happens as a result, as a direct result, is the first building codes in the United States are passed. The first laws that say you cannot build any kind of a structure without blueprints, and without those blueprints being approved by some government entity. And that's an important outcome, a very important outcome to what might seem like a silly little incident or a silly big incident. And you can go all the way down the line and see all of that.
14,000 tons of molasses, I think I read in the book. That's almost impossible to wrap your head around.
Honest to God, there's so many of these things that are impossible to wrap your head around. You're absolutely right. And can you imagine a 45-foot wave coming at 30 miles an hour at you? That'll kill you. Splinter, as the pictures show, that'll splinter houses like a tornado.
And good luck.
It's not funny.
Right, and good luck swimming in molasses. It's probably not going to work out very well.
It's great also, you know, having grown up around Boston, you know, there were so many myths about it that could persist today. Like, sure, if you walk around downtown Boston, on the north end of Boston today, and it's a warm day, you're going to smell the molasses still eking up from between the cobblestones. Not really. Not after 100 years. But still, it's an extraordinary story, and it's a human story. And it kicks off. To me, what's important is it's just a remarkable story to begin a remarkable year. I mean, the year ends with this remarkable story about who would have thunk it. I mean, you know, when I first started writing, I had a sign at my desk that said you couldn't make that up. You know, well, who the hell could make up this molasses flood story? But then on the other hand, the year ends with prohibition. And, you know, who can make up that story? Who can make up a story with a government telling you you can't go to a bar because we're going to wipe out the bars, or you can't manufacture liquor or so forth? It's who the heck knew?
Right. Well, the first interesting thing that you notice in the book is, like you said, this crazy molasses story. Okay, that seems like it could be an isolated incident that would go down as a footnote in history, but we realize pretty quickly that there are lots of ramifications, lots of causes that brought about mm-hmm. this tragedy. But then the fallout after that, and the things that all are connected. It's really
eerie when you start looking at the cause and effect of a lot of these things. But the other
That's a good point. And the key word that you use is connectedness. I mean, one of the things, I mean, I knew I was going to do this book the minute I saw all these things. In fact, I looked at a couple of these stories, like the Alcock and Brown flight across the Atlantic. And I said, maybe I should just do a book on that, you know? I mean, and I decided just to do it all, but because the year itself. But and one of the reasons I decided to do it all is because of the word you use, and that is connectedness. Because as I was researching the molasses flood, I suddenly am reading that on the day after the flood, when you got Red Cross workers and policemen and firemen digging through the rubble, trying desperately to find survivors, if there are any, all of a sudden, all the church bells in Boston start to go off joyously. Why? And then you find out that they're doing that because at that very moment, the last state needed to pass prohibition just passed it. And the proponents of prohibition are ringing the church bells. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy how, I mean, you know, I really believe that one of the greatest characters ever to come out of American history or of anybody's history is the American gangster. Well, the American gangster is absolutely born out of prohibition. And you know, you find out that, yeah, they did all these incredible, interesting to me stuff during the prohibition, but it's these same guys, the very same people who financed and brought about the White Sox throwing the World Series, something that no one ever could have thought was possible. So this interconnectedness is very, very important.
It is. It's stunning, you know, and just page after page of the book that you realize, you know, you couldn't plan this out. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, who'd have thunk it?
Fiction, you couldn't make it up.
No fiction writer would come up with a plot like this. It would never sell. It's too.
Nobody'd believe them.
Right. Exactly. But the other thing that you notice, and there are lots of parallels between 1919 and where we're living today in 2019. You know, 1919 was, by my off-the-cuff calculations, just over 50 years after the end of the Civil War, yet 1919 showed us more lynchings and race-related issues than ever before. At the end of the Civil War, I'm sure there were lots of people that said, okay, well, this is settled. We can go about rebuilding and, you know, the world can be a better place. Well, then 50 years later, it's worse than it was. And then standing in 2019, you know, we can look at the progress that we've made and we can still see progress yet to come. I wonder in 1919, when you're looking forward to 100 years from now, I hope that my grandkids have done better than we've had, than we've done.
That's a very good point. One of the things I try to get across is that, you know, progress is never a straight line. I try to get across the fact that we've been making progress since we were born. You know, we were born in slavery. We were born in very hard times. But we have been making, but then we've had setbacks. And, and this whole thing that I hope one of the side things that comes out of this, and when they read that chapter, which I think is one of the most important chapters in the book, and that is on the what we call the Red Summer, and see that, you know, what replaced slavery was sharecropping. Every bit as bad as, not every bit as bad, but almost every bit as bad as slavery. It's another form of slavery. And it's one of the largest riots that we had, the largest full-scale riots that we had took place in all places, Arkansas, when a group of sharecroppers had the temerity to try to form a union in order to get maybe a living wage. And the whites responded by bringing in mercenaries to beat them down. And so it's a very tough period, and there's a lot of history to be learned. But on the other hand, you know, you get to see that during the same period, the civil rights movement is born, the NAACP is born, and we move forward. We're going through very hard times today, but we'll get through it because if history teaches us anything, then, you know, we get through slavery. We got through we got through a lot of stuff, and we will get through this, but it's painful. And I guess that's what life is. And but most important of all, it's human. And if you tell the story in a human way, then it's understandable.
Well, and the way that you tell these stories in a human way is by connecting us to people that were involved in this. How did you go about discovering not just the events and the push pins that we could put on the map for 1919, but actually anchoring these things to the human condition and to humans that were experiencing
these
things?
That is so perfect, because that's what I do first. I look for the people. I look to find as many, many firsthand statements and quotes and stuff from them as I can. I try to get them to tell the story as much as I can. I try to, you know, I love great reviews and I tattoo them on my arms, but I got to tell you that the greatest reviews I can get, when they, and I've had them, thank God, is when they say Mr. Sandler has seamlessly woven the stories, the people's own statements, with his writing. I mean, that's what it's all about for me. It really is. And what I found in this, and I've saved it for one of the last things, what I found in this is that this book is filled with some of the most remarkable characters in the whole history of America. I mean, it's filled with Alice Paul, who almost no one knows about, but who is really the person behind women getting the vote. And she's been neglected by history. And she is one of the most, never mind more important female characters, she's one of the most important characters of all time. And at the same time, you've got one of the most outrageous female characters that ever lived in Carrie Nation, walking around with a hatchet, chopping everything down that she can. You've got all of these gangsters, as I talked about. You've got two pilots who are risking their lives doing the most stupid thing in the eyes of many people that you can imagine. You've got these incredible baseball players who've got the dilemma, we're not getting paid enough, so we'll throw the World Series. You know, you've got an Attorney General of the United States who makes McCarthy look like a piker in deporting people for no reason, no valid reason, in throwing people for jail without due cause. I mean, you've got heroes, you've got villains, and you got a great story. And you know, you couldn't make it up, and I didn't make it up. And I'm not responsible for it, but I'm sure delighted that I had the privilege of being able to tell it.
Right. One of my grandfathers, my dad's dad, was born in 1899, and he died in the mid-1970s. And you know, from being born in 1899, he literally saw technology advance from horse and buggies and horse-drawn plow. He was a farmer, to us putting a man on the moon in one lifetime. And
That's amazing. Only in America, right.
And then when you read this book, like 1919, you see the tinderbox that really lit all of those innovations. Previously, before that, we started seeing industrialization that fueled a lot of that. But from 1919 on is really the explosion. That happened. We were coming home from World War I. Can you name, a factor or two that you think really fueled the advancement that we had in 1919 in this past 100 years?
Well, you know, people are always looking to advance. I mean, I'm not going to talk about any invention or anything, but you know, you got women struggling for the vote. You've got women struggling for the vote forever. And they finally get it for the reasons I've described, you know, mainly out of shock value, out of people, so many women being tortured, and that's the right word, and so many of these people fighting for the right being abused, and finally people becoming aware of that. But that's 100 years later, you get the Me Too movement. There is no Me Too movement without what these people struggled for. You know, and in many ways, the Me Too movement is more effective than what took place in 1919. But we still got a long way to go. And hopefully 10 years from now, there'll be something more effective than the Me Too movement. But it's a battle. And, you know, you can get frustrated. I mean, how many times you got to fight this thing? How many times, what seems more obvious than women having control of their own bodies and women having the right to vote, more than half the population of this country having the right to vote? You know, it just seems so obvious to me, and yet they have had to struggle, and so many people have been injured physically and spiritually by all of this. And so, what I'm hoping in the work I do is that by making history palatable, by making it come alive, people will understand what we've gone through, particularly young people will understand it, that there ain't much new in this world, but that we continually battle and we continually make progress, even though it's not in this straight line that I talked about.
You know, when you read these stories, like women getting the right to vote, that was not a slam dunk. There was a fight that had to happen to gain that right. It was not, you know, unanimous across the board by any means. But then other things like prohibition, the same thing. This was not something that everyone wanted. There was a fight about this. And, you know, we know that was repealed a few years later. In modern day America today, when we're recording this, we are actively impeaching a president today. And we think that the world has never been more divided than it is right now. And then we read back 100 years and divisions are still there. People are still fighting and, you know, there are differing opinions all over the place. What can we take in 2019 going into 2020 from the way people lived and died in 1919? What can we take from the lessons they given us?
It sounds like it, doesn't it? Sound like like this division. These divisions are part of the human condition. You know, there are always people who will differ from our opinion, or we'll differ from their opinion. You know, I think that what one can take away from 1919 is that you know, no matter when we hit our lowest in that particular year, we bounce back. For example, in this Red Scare, when you got this guy Palmer, who is and he's got lots and lots and lots of followers, including a guy named J. Edgar Hoover, who's in charge of an agency that's going to become the FBI. Well, you've got all this going on, and you've got these poor people being deported for no reason at all, except they look different. And you've got people being accused of communists when the people who are accusing them of communists don't even know what a communist is. And yet, it all gets repealed. Palmer, who comes very close to becoming a very serious nominee for president of the United States, is finally put in his place. He's finally removed. You've got the government apologizing for these terrible, terrible things that have taken place. And it comes, I can't say a happy ending, but it comes to the ending it should come to. You've got, as I mentioned before, you've got this Red Summer, and it's called red because blood is being shed, and then blood of black people is being shed. And yet, you're getting a movement toward where people are understanding this is not right. And we cannot be a nation and have this continue. And when we get to where we are today, where we sure in hell have a lot further to go. But when one thinks, and I don't mean to be a Pollyanna about this, but when you think back where we were in 1919 and where we are today, and yet, you know, we've seen in the last four years, there are setbacks. And we continually have to battle. And it may be, you know, I've gotten old enough to realize maybe it's none of these things are ever going to be settled forever. And that's why history is even more important, because we better know about them so we can keep fighting about them. Because if we don't keep fighting for them, they're going to go a different way. And, you know, we don't want that to happen.
Well, if we've learned anything, it's that progress lumbers forward. It's not fast, and yeah, sometimes
that's
we
even a better way than I put it.
we zig and zag forward to the sides, but you know, slowly,
yeah,
it lumbers forward.
Yeah, well, I guess it is a human condition, when you know, only you and I are perfect.
That's right. That's right. But if they would just ask us, we could tell them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
The book is 1919, The Year That Changed America. One thing that I love about this book, Mr. Sandler, is that it is for every member of the family. I think everyone needs to have this book on their shelf. It is fully accessible to...
Oh, you want to put that blurb on the jacket?
I would be happy to. I would be happy to. But it's well, fully accessible...
That was the intent, and let's just hope that is true. Well, that's great.
It's fully accessible for young readers, older readers like me. There's lots to discover in here. And I think that, you know, family time spent with this book would be an amazing thing to see happen in 2020. The book is available everywhere now.